That? Can we just do that? I got all excited. I'm all excited. I will tell you, the first time I watched that and Chewie gets shot, like my heart broke. Like a little bit. Nobody should shoot Chewie. That's not okay. Okay, so there's this New Testament writer, and he's writing about the Word of God, which we understand to be the Holy Scriptures, at least in this context. It's the Holy Scriptures. And he says that the Word of God is living and active. The writer goes on to say that the Word of God, it cuts through, it divides soul and spirit. And it exposes our innermost thoughts and desires. Now that is very fancy talk for this. The Bible is meant for us to read it, understand it, and then learn about God and learn about ourselves and kind of shape what it is we want. And the Bible does that. It helps us to see who we are, and it helps us to see who God is, and it shapes what we want out of life by always being living and active, by always being new. Here's the thing that's amazing about the Bible. You can hear the same stories over and over and over, and there's always something new to learn. You can read the same passages over and over and over, and somebody can point out something new, somebody can point out something you've never heard before, there's always going to be something new. That's the beauty of the Scriptures. And so this morning, I'm going to tell you guys something, it's probably new to you. And, you know, at least for me, as of, you know, about 6 months ago, it was new to me. And at first you're going to think, well, that doesn't really sound like anything. And then you're going to think, well, what in the world does that have to do with anything? But the Bible is living and active. And the more new things we learn, the more things we're supposed to apply to our lives. And so there's this new pattern. It's not new, it's very old. It's new to me, hopefully new to you. There's this pattern within the Scriptures that teaches us a very, very important lesson. And that pattern begins with the very first story that we see in this world. By that I mean outside of the Garden of Eden. Okay, so biblical timeline, you begin with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They mess up, they're kicked out. And then the first people we learn about in this world of pain and suffering and, you know, crops not growing quite so well and strife and violence and all that, is a story about two brothers. They were the sons of Adam and Eve. And the older one was named Cain. The younger one was named Abel. Most of you have probably heard this story before. Cain was a farmer. Abel was a shepherd. And Cain and Abel both wanted to know the God of their parents. They both wanted to have a relationship in whatever way they could with the God that Adam and Eve had told them about. And so both of them did something that was very, very common in the ancient world, very, very common among essentially every ancient religion, and that was they decided to make a sacrifice to God. Abel, we're told, made a sacrifice, and Cain, we're told, made a sacrifice. And God accepted Abel's sacrifice and blessed him, but God rejected Cain's sacrifice and did not bless him. That is essentially the story of Cain and Abel. Now, so you guys who've heard this story, most of the time at this point, when we talk about why it was that God did not accept Cain's sacrifice. And we have a couple of different answers that a lot of times we just kind of give and we say, okay, that has to be it. The first answer that is often given is, as the question is asked, why did God not accept Cain's sacrifice, is the type of sacrifice that it was. The biblical writer tells us that Abel gave of the finest part, the first part of his flocks. Well, we're not told anything about Cain's sacrifice at all. So we make the leap, which is not that hard to make the leap to say that maybe what was happening was Abel's sacrifice was acceptable to God because of the way the sacrifice was, while Cain's was not. Abel gave more of himself than Cain did. There's just one problem with that theory, and that's this. God never told them to make a sacrifice. That's not anywhere in the Bible. So if God didn't tell them to make a sacrifice, he certainly did not tell them how to make a sacrifice. Which means that Abel and Cain were both kind of just going off the cuff. They don't have a template to look at. And so it seems a little unreasonable for God to be upset with Abel or with Cain for not doing a thing he never told him to do. You know, that doesn't seem fair. So it might not be that at all. Okay, so our second answer that we give very often about this whole thing is we think about, you know, okay, maybe it's not so much the sacrifice, but it was the attitude behind the sacrifice. You know, the story depicts Cain as being very angry, as being very dejected, very discouraged. It kind of tells him of a guy who he doesn't really have a great attitude. And so maybe it was that Cain was just kind of a bad dude. And he didn't live a life that God, that honored God, and he didn't live a life that God was happy about, and so this sacrifice meant nothing because his actions didn't match up to his religious ritual. Maybe it was that. And maybe Abel was a good guy, and that's why God accepted his sacrifice. And so, very often, that's the explanation that we give. And there's just one problem with that, too. If you read carefully in the story, which is in Genesis chapter 4, in case you want to look this up, Cain isn't upset until after God rejects him. Like, the order is sacrifice, God says, I don't accept it, then Cain gets mad. Cain isn't mad before in the story. Cain's mad after. And so, again, maybe that's what it is, but it's a very strange thing. The story is actually quite ambiguous. We're not told why God accepts Abel's sacrifice and not Cain's. And we can guess, and we can question, and we can ponder over it, but the truth is the Bible doesn't really tell us. And so I think there's a better question to ask. Setting that question aside, and saying, okay, we can't know that. Here's the question. I guess, spoiler alert for the end of the story, Cain gets very angry and kills Abel. It's bloodthirsty, it's cruel, it's like with a rock or something, at least it's not okay. So, you know, Cain ends up cursed by God, yada, 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 but here's the question. Why did Cain even care about Abel? What does Abel have to do with Cain's relationship with God? I mean, think about that. The story, Cain and Abel, I mean, why is he taking his anger out on Abel? Why not take it out on somebody else? Why worry about Abel? Why, what does Abel have anything to do with Cain at all? I think that's a much better question to ask, given the information we have. And to answer that question, we need only to understand the way that the ancient world worked in literally every culture ever. See, here's the way things worked back in the day. And by that I mean every culture we have ever observed in recorded human history. This has been the way it is. A father wants to hand down what he has to his children. And the oldest son gets whatever it is that he has. The oldest son, 100% of the time, is the heir. And so if you're a farmer and you have to hand down a farm, you give it to your oldest son. Or at least you give the bigger chunk to your oldest son. If you're a banker or a carpenter or whatever, you hand all that down. That's the way it works. It's not even always a good thing. Sometimes you have to hand down responsibility. You know, if your job is no fun, you have all these difficulties with your job, you're handing that down to the oldest son. This is the way it worked. The oldest son always, 100% of the time, was the heir. The main chief heir. Now, if you think about it, there's a reason for that. Like, let's say that you want to have a family with, you know, your significant other. And let's say, for example, that you want to have a variety of children. When you have the first one, there's no guarantee once that first one exists that there's ever going to be a second or a third or a fourth. So if you need to have an heir, you're going to pick the one that exists, not the one that theoretically exists. It makes sense. In every culture, the oldest was always the one who was blessed. Always. Except for here. Except for in this story. Cain is the oldest. Abel is the little brother. And God blesses Abel, not Cain. To Cain, from his perspective, the reason he's mad at Abel is because Abel had taken what was rightfully his. And I don't want to say that Cain the murderer was right, but Cain the murderer was right. Like, he wasn't right to kill his brother, but he was totally right in that blessing belonged by rights to him. By the way, every culture had universally agreed upon the rules of the world. Cain should have been blessed before Abel, no matter what else happened. And so Cain, seeing his brother taking what is rightfully his, says, okay, well, if Abel's going to take what's mine, if I kill him, then there's nobody else to take what's mine, and I'll get it. He's just getting rid of the heir so that way he gets the blessing. A pattern is set forth with this action. Again and again and again. Over and over in the scriptures. It might not seem like much, but again and again, what you see is this pattern. Where there's an older brother and a younger brother. And the world says, universally agreed upon cultural norms, say the oldest gets the blessing. And again and again and again, we see God blessing the little brother. Okay, so one time that's not enough for a pattern. Let's go the second time it happens. Fast forward, it's a guy named Abraham. God calls Abraham. He says, Abraham, you're going to be the father of many nations. He looks to the sky and he says, hey, you see all the stars in the sky? You will have children that outnumber the stars. And he tells Abraham and his wife, Sarah, you guys will be my covenant people. He says that through the family you will build together, I will bless the entire world. That's what God promises Abraham. And Abraham and Sarah do their very, very best to trust this, to believe this. But the problem is, Sarah and Abraham keep trying to get pregnant and it's not working. And so they're doing their best to believe in what God is saying, to trust in God's plan, but it just doesn't work out. So one day, Sarah comes up with this plan. She goes to Abraham and she says, listen, you're supposed to be the father of many nations. You're supposed to have a lot of different descendants. I'm not giving you even a single descendant. So why don't we find somebody else? You have a child with her and you'll have a descendant. Abraham, being an idiot, says, yeah, that won't backfire. And so he finds a servant girl named Hagar. They, you know each other in that way. And she gets pregnant. And she has a son named Ishmael. Sarah, to the surprise of literally no one who's ever spoken to another human being, ever, she gets jealous of this. She's not happy with this. And so she starts treating Hagar horribly. She starts treating Ishmael horribly. And not even the birth of her own son, named Isaac, changes how horribly she treats Ishmael and Hagar. And it all came to a head one day when there was this party for Isaac. So they throw in this party, and everybody's invited, all the friends, all the family. It's this nice backyard barbecue. And Ishmael and Hagar are playing around. Isaac and Ishmael, they're little kids. They don't understand adult drama, so they're just playing in the corner over here. And Sarah gets very, very upset. And she goes to Abraham, and she says, how long do I have to put up with this other woman around here and her child? You've got to get rid of them. Abraham wants nothing to do with this because Abraham's firstborn son is Ishmael. The heir is Ishmael. He loves Ishmael. Which isn't to say he doesn't love Isaac. Which isn't to say that Isaac is anything. It's just Isaac's the secondborn, not the firstborn. And so Abraham is distraught. He doesn't know what to do. He's trying to do what's right with his family. He's trying to do what's right, with his culture. He's trying to, obviously his wife is a little unhinged. She keeps coming up with these plans and then she doesn't like it. And he's trying to deal with this. And so he goes to God and God intervenes. And he says, listen, I'll tell you what. Do what your wife says. God said that, husbands. He says, do what your wife says. Go ahead and send away Hagar and Ishmael. And God said, I will bless them. I will take care of them. I will absolutely, no worries, you don't have to worry about Ishmael. I will make Ishmael the father of a great nation. I will absolutely bless him and take care of him. He said, but those promises about blessing the world, that covenant I'm making with you, this special purpose I have for your family, I'll do that through Isaac. I'll take care of Ishmael, but Isaac will get this huge, massive blessing as my covenant son. And so again, older brother Ishmael passed over by God for little brother Isaac. Now you might be saying, okay, Drew, well look, you've kind of glossed over some things, okay? Obviously we've got, you know, the child that was the son of a slave, and you brought up all that Cain stuff, and you tried to explain it away, but, you know, Cain still might have been a bad guy. So two is not enough for a pattern. There's extenuating circumstances. Okay, I'm hearing you out. So let's talk about the third one. It comes along rather quickly. It's Isaac's children. He has twin boys. The older was named Esau. The younger was named Jacob. And again, the pattern goes. But this time, it's not because of any extenuating circumstances other than Jacob, the younger one, is a bad human. Here's what happens. Isaac is getting old. He's very, very old. He's going blind. He's gone blind. And the only senses he can really use are touch and smell. That's how he can tell who people are. He can't see anybody anymore. And so he wants to, as he's getting old, he realizes my life is about done. And he says, I want to bless my eldest son. I want to give him the inheritance. I want to give him my blessing. I want to make official what is really, I want to give him officially what is his by right. And so he goes to Esau and he says, listen, son, I'm not long for this world. I want to share this beautiful moment with you. So what I want you to do is I want you to go hunt. Esau was a wonderful hunter. And he says, I want you to go hunt. I want you to prepare an animal, prepare a meal for me. And then I will bless you and I will make you my heir officially. It'll be a beautiful moment between the two of us. So Esau, doing what he's supposed to be doing, goes out and goes to hunt. And it's then that Jacob and his mother, who for whatever reason favored him, came up with a plan. They said, well, listen, your father, he can't see anymore. So if you make yourself smell like Esau, and you make yourself feel like Esau, and you show up in that room with some food, he'll never know the difference. So that's what happens. Poor smelly Esau smelled like the outdoors because he was a hunter. Poor hairy Esau apparently was Wolfman or something, so he put on a goat skin. This is in the Bible, by the way, goat skin on him with all the fur. And Jacob, dressed like his brother, smelling like his brother, food in hand, goes to his father and says, I'm Esau. Here's your food. Give me the inheritance. And Isaac does it. And Esau's angry when he comes back and finds out. And you think that God wouldn't really want to honor a liar and a cheater and a scoundrel. And yet, for the third time in the story of God's people, very, very quickly, God chooses to bless the younger over the older. Older brother Esau does not receive that blessing or inheritance. Younger brother Jacob gets it. And here a few chapters later, when there's this wrestling with God and God officially makes Israel into Israel, it's Jacob whose name is Israel. It's Jacob, the cheater, the young guy. The names are going to get bigger. We're going to talk about those names over the next 6 weeks or so. But the lesson over and over and over, the pattern is there. You can't unsee it. Once you see it, it's one of those things like, you know, like you never, somebody tells you about a song on the radio and then for the next 2 weeks, all you hear is that one song. It's like that. Like once you see in the scriptures that there's this weird pattern, you keep seeing it over and over and over. Over and over again, God blesses the little brother over the older brother. Which is exactly the opposite of the way every culture in recorded human history has decided things should go. Of all the things that mankind has disagreed on, I mean, you can't get five people in a car to decide which pizza place to go to. Even if you decide we're going to get pizza tonight, now everybody's got their own favorite place. You can't get anybody to agree on anything with human beings, and yet human beings universally agreed. The oldest is the heir. The oldest is the blessed one. The oldest is the favored one. And God, again and again and again, does the exact opposite. So the question is, other than the fact that I'm the youngest of four children, why am I telling you this? What are we supposed to learn? So the Bible is living and active. We're supposed to learn new things. And then those new things are supposed to help us to learn who God is and who we are. And it's supposed to change or expose the desires of our hearts. What are we supposed to learn from all of this? Like, there's this pattern. But what does that have to do with you or me? And I think the answer is this. You see, God is not changed by our opinions. God's kingdom is very, very different. When Jesus came along and said that he was a king of a kingdom that was not of this world, he said, the first will be last and the last will be first. He talked about a reversal of order. In other words, the world around us is kind of messed up. And so whatever we decide is right has no bearing on God whatsoever. And in this, again and again and again and again, God is very subtly, almost subconsciously teaching us, I don't operate like you. I do not rule like your rulers. I do not lead like your leaders. My kingdom is not like everybody else's. If we picture the kingdom of God like any earthly kingdom, we're doing it wrong. If we picture the way God operates like any human being, we're doing it wrong. Over and over and over, there's this part of the story where there's this universally agreed upon standard that all human beings ever in all places have decided is right. And God says, meh, I don't care. I'm going to do things this way. Again and again and again, God is showing he is different. Now, why is that good news? Why is that anything that we should be wanting to preach or talk about? Well, there's this. You see, the way men rule, it's not so healthy. The way we govern ourselves, it's not so good. The standards we come up with, I mean, they can make sense, kind of, but at the end of the day, they're not loving to everyone. They're not compassionate for everyone. I mean, we're very good at being nice to a few people, but we're not very good at being nice to everybody. The kingdoms we build, the values we have, we shouldn't want that to be God's. I mean, look around. If there wasn't better news than what we see each and every day, that would be a very depressing thing indeed. Because here's the deal. We live in a world that constantly bombards you with a single message. And that message is given in every possible different way, but it's the same message again and again. And it's conveyed in ways when our world tells us that to be happy you need to buy a certain thing. Or you need to own a certain thing. You need to drive a certain thing. You need to wear clothes with a certain number on it. You need to vote for a certain thing. You need to be part of a country that's a certain way. You need to think a certain way and act a certain way and all those things. The message we're being told over and over and over in this world by everyone is this. You are not good enough. Every day you are told in ways big and small that you are not good enough. You will be good enough if you can just, you know, get the right degree. You will be good enough if you can just get the right job or buy the right house. You will be good enough if something that's about you that you were born with, that there's no possible way you could change, if that could change, well, then you'd be good enough. If your marriage could be better, you'd be good enough. If your kids would be better, you'd be good enough. If you made a little more money, you'd be good enough. If you looked a little more like the commercials, you'd be good enough. If you could lose enough weight, you'd be good enough. Over and over and over and over and over, we are told you are not good enough, but you will be when you do this thing. And so here comes God. And he says, again and again and again, all those voices, I don't listen to them. All those voices that tell you that you're not good enough, again and again, they mean nothing to me. over and over, God communicates this crazy notion that the world telling us we're not good enough is wrong. Because God does not listen to the values of this world. Even something we could universally agree on, like the oldest son is the one who gets the blessing. This thing, when five people can't decide on whether to go to Pizza Hut or Pizza Haas, we all decide there's just one thing we're supposed to do, and God still looks at that and says, no, you don't change me. And that's amazing news. Because the world around us is trying to change everybody. But it doesn't change God. And so the message from God is very, very simple. No matter what any other voices say, the voice that I am speaking with is the voice you need to listen to. And here's what's amazing. So it's amazing. In the New Testament, there's this guy, his name is Paul, and he writes this letter to this church at Corinth. And here's what he writes about the church. Here's what he writes. He says this. He says, remember, dear brothers and sisters, that few of you were wise in the world's eyes, or powerful, or wealthy when God called you. Instead, God chose things the world considers foolish in order to shame those who think they are wise. And he chose things that are powerless to shame those who are powerful. God chose things despised by the world, things counted as nothing at all, and used them to bring to nothing what the world considers important. As a result, no one can ever boast in the presence of God. This sounds like a backhanded compliment, and it is a little bit. Paul is saying, look, you guys, according to the rest of the world, you're kind of dumb. Sorry. According to the rest of the world, you mean nothing. You have no power. No one cares what you have to say. According to the rest of the world, you have nothing. You're poor. And you know how little God cares, or how much God cares about what the rest of the world thinks? God called you when everyone else thought you were dumb. God called you when everyone else said you were poor. God called you when everyone else said you meant nothing. Let me word it as bluntly as I can. Somebody out there right now believes that you're not good for anything. You're so not good for anything that there is a God who made you who is just waiting to throw you into hell because you are so bad. And God doesn't care. Right now, out there, there are tons of people who say you're not good enough. You're not smart enough. You're not wealthy enough. You're not enough anything. Do a thing and you'll be good enough. And God is saying those people are all wrong. You are loved and you are valued by God no matter what anybody else says. And of all the voices saying you are not good enough, the one voice who will never ever say that is Jesus. Because it's never been about you being good enough for God. It's never been about that. God looked at Abel and said, yeah, he's a little brother, but I'm going to bless him anyway. God looked at Isaac and said, yeah, he's not the firstborn, but I'll bless him anyway. He looked at Jacob and said, this guy is terrible. Yeah, I'll bless him anyway. It's never been about you being good enough for anything. It's been about God loving you. And Christianity is not believing the right thing. It is not being the right thing. It's not doing the right thing. Christianity is embracing this idea that God is unique. And he's doing something in your world and in your life. And you embracing that and saying, I will trust you in grace. I will trust you in faith. And I will allow you to change me into a gracious person in your image. Of all the voices the world throws at you saying you're not enough, that voice is never Jesus. This morning, we're beginning our series called Little Brothers. The next 6 weeks, we're going to talk about God blessing surprising people in surprising ways. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. And over again, as the names get bigger and bigger and more familiar to us, we're going to find that again and again, God is blessing little brothers. People that no one else in the world would ever think to bless. And he uses little brothers, people in the world would never have guessed to bless. But before we go to those big names, we've got to get this foundation set. Our first lesson from the little brothers is this. No matter what anyone else may say, God says you are loved and valuable. No matter what anyone else may say, God says you are loved and you are valuable. We begin this morning, as we will for the next 6 weeks, with Episode 7 of Star Wars. It is wonderful. If you don't like Star Wars, how dare you? But, anyway, this is something, I think the reason we all love Star Wars is every single person, when you think about it, if you take a step back, and we're going to take a step back, if you take a step back, every character in Star Wars is a very unlikely hero. It's never the one that you would have guessed. It's never the one the world would have said was wise or powerful or amazing that is the hero. It's always somebody you wouldn't expect. We witnessed old Han Solo and Chewbacca here. They've been from the beginning. From the very beginning of this, you've had Chewbacca and Han Solo. But when you think about it, that's really weird. We first meet Han Solo and he's a criminal. He's a smuggler. He's a guy that a gangster has put a hit out on. The first time we meet him, a gangster's put a hit out on him and he has to shoot somebody to survive. Han Solo is not a good dude. Chewbacca, he's a Wookiee. Giant walking carpets. Wookiees come from this planet called Kashyyyk. Kashyyyk is a slave planet. The Empire came in and enslaved every Wookiee on that planet. He was freed by Han Solo and now he's a fugitive. You have a criminal and a freed fugitive slave. Those are our heroes. And they are. And yet the world never would have guessed that. I submit that it's time we stopped worrying about the world might guess at. It is high time that we as Christians, when the world starts shouting, we just kind of tune them out. When the world shouts, you're not good enough, just stop listening. When the world says, you should start telling other people they're not good enough, we should definitely tune that out. Over and again, there are voices that are telling us to perpetuate a message of something that's not love and compassion and mercy and grace. And every time we hear that, we have to turn off our ears and say, we will listen only to Christ. Christ says we are good enough. Christ says everyone is good enough because it's not about being good, it's about God. The God we serve is the God of the little brother. He's the God of Abel. He is the God of Isaac. He is the God of Jacob. He is the God of people like Han and Chewie and you and me. People that the world thinks are nothing, but in God's estimation, are very, very much something. You are loved. You are valuable, regardless of what anyone else says. This morning, a musician's going to come forward. They're going to sing a song. And we embrace this message not to earn anything, but instead as an expression that we understand. The Bible teaches us that we repent and be baptized. We don't do this so that God will say, okay, well now you're good enough and I won't throw you into hell. That is, look, the good news is so much better than that. It's ridiculous. The good news is God tells us you were always good enough because it was never about goodness. It's about me. And when we understand that, we reorient our lives, we turn our backs on who we used to be, we say, I want to do things God's way. I want to be part of this different kingdom that's not of this world. This kingdom in which love and compassion are greater than judgment and fear. And when we are baptized, we join ourselves to Christ and His kingdom, to Christ and His resurrection. It's like we go down in some water, it's like our old selves being buried, we get out of that water, it's like our new selves being born again. You've never made that decision? Nice warm baptistry, lots of people can do it. If you're in an immersed